Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter. Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jarovich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. There are work commutes, and then there are long hauls. Dr. Deanna LaBianca falls into the latter category. Every other month, she travels from her home in Columbus to Nome, Alaska, where she is the town's only pediatrician. And she joins us now from Alaska. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. LaBianca.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy. I used to listen to NPR on my commute in the morning when I still drove to work. So it's a joy to be here.
Oh, we're happy to have you. And I've heard of long commutes, but you know, this takes the cake. I understand you aren't the only Ohio doctor practicing in Alaska. It was through a friendship forged while at Ohio State that led you to this job. But how did you end up as a doctor in Alaska every other month?
It was primarily through a friendship that started at Ohio State University. I met my dear friend Mackenzie Rapp in an organic chemistry lecture our sophomore year, and we had a tremendous time at Ohio State. I was part of Alpha Phi Omega, which rings the victory bell whenever the Buckeyes win in the SHU, and she and I were college roommates our senior year. We've been friends since then. She went on to become a family practice physician, and I'm a pediatrician, of course. And she did her residency in Alaska and stayed to work. So she and her husband, who's also a family practice doctor, have been up here for maybe 8 going on 9 years. And she's been kind of putting a bug in my ear for a long time, telling me stories about what it is to live and work in Alaska. And, you know, oh, you could come join us. And it wasn't until recently that I decided to do a trip up there and visit and explore and fell in love.
So are you employed by a hospital or like a healthcare system in Alaska?
I'm employed by Norton Sound Health Corporation. So I am the only full-time staff pediatrician. Up until as of last week, we just hired a pediatrician to be full-time on my alternating on my off month. So we will now have full pediatric coverage for the first time in probably at least a decade.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's what my next question was, does Nome have any homegrown pediatricians?
Not currently. Nome is a pretty tiny town. The actual city limits might be larger, but in terms of where I walk, it's maybe 10 by 20 blocks wide. So it takes me 15 minutes to walk to work each day. There's no stoplights or anything. And historically, what we've been doing for pediatric care is, I should clarify, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants here. There are pediatricians who have been coming up from Anchorage doing what we call fields clinics. And that's how a lot of Nome receives its specialty care, be it ear, nose, and throat, cardiology, whatever it may be. So we've had pediatricians from Alaska Native Medical Center coming up and doing their field clinics for a week at a time for decades. And they've been seeing the sickest of the sick, children who have had bone marrow transplants, whatever it may be, and they've come to be there for these families for many, many years, and they still do their field clinics, which I'm so grateful for, sometimes virtually, sometimes in person. But when I'm physically in Nome, I'm often the only pediatrician physically there. But again, that's going to change for the better soon, which I'm really looking forward to.
And you serve Nome, Alaska, and then the surrounding villages, but most people, I think, probably haven't been to Alaska. Can you tell us a little bit about Nome? I mean, you describe a little bit more about how big it is and how many people live there.
So the actual city limits is probably about over 20 miles. But again, the town itself, like that I am able to get around because I don't have a vehicle, is fairly small. I can walk across it in 20 minutes, and about 3,500 people maybe live in town. And our hospital is an 18-bed critical access hospital that serves about 15 surrounding villages across the Norton Sound Bering Strait region. So some of the areas that we take care of include St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea, which is about an hour by plane. We take care of the village of Little Diomede. One of our physicians will take a helicopter and take care of the 80 or so people who live on Little Diomede every other month as well.
Do you, when you have to treat patients who are from the outlying villages and not in Nome itself, do they come to you or do you make house calls?
It varies. We frequently fly people in for their visits in Nome. We'll also do virtual visits. Alaska was among the first to do their video teleconference. So our video visits as it became popular in COVID. I'll be stationed in Nome and do virtual visits, or there's no roads in or out of Nome. So everybody has to fly in for care if they're coming from a surrounding village. But we also do our field clinics out in the villages. So I've traveled to two so far. And our pediatricians from Anchorage have done a number of field clinics in the villages over the years as well. And I'll hopefully be traveling to more. I've got another one scheduled for next month.
What's the weather like there right now? How cold is it?
Right now, so when I left Ohio, which was just earlier this week, it was as cold in Ohio as it was in Nome. Right now, it's 5 degrees. When I had left the month before, it was -27. And that feels cold.
Negative 27 is cold. I was going to say Ohio this morning when I left my house, it was -1. So we were having Alaska weather here, but that's not all the
We
time,
were.
right? And Alaska, it's more all the time in the winter, I'm guessing.
The winters up here, so when I was up here in beginning of January, end of December, what the days look like is the sun will rise, and I use air quotes because it comes up over their horizon. It never gets fully overhead in the middle of winter, but it'll come up over the horizon from maybe noon to four. So I've seen a lot of gorgeous sunrises and sunsets. And it'll be dark the rest of the time. So when I'm getting ready to walk to work, if it's around 10 to 15 degrees, I'm good. I'm happy, I'm content. If it's above zero, not too windy, I'm good. Below that, I need to layer up with my snow pants. I've got a face covering, like a buff mask that goes over my nose and mouth. And then I've got my clear goggles because it's nighttime, to cover my eyes. So I have to have every part of my body covered. My hands, I'll do liner gloves and then some mittens over it. And I've got ice cleats that I put on my boots because even if there's snow, there's layers of ice underneath and it can be quite slick. And that's how I make my commute. I've got my reflective armbands and a little light as well in my backpack.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Dr. Deanna LaBianca. She travels every other month to Nome, Alaska, where she's the only pediatrician serving the remote town and surrounding villages. When we were talking about how remote it is, a quick Wikipedia search told me that a gallon of milk there costs $8. Is that true? Is that because it's so remote, like getting goods in costs extra?
Feels true. Yeah, that feels about right. It is hard to get goods up here. We do have Amazon now, and it takes maybe 2 weeks to get like a package through Prime. Some family members apparently sent me something over the holidays, and I just got a picture from a friend with the postcard that was returned to them several weeks or months later.
Go ahead.
So in the wintertime, the sea is frozen over. We can't barge things up. That's a way to get supplies up to the region during the summer months. So when that's frozen over and we have to rely on plane, the weather often dictates whether or not we can get goods in. If there's too much fog or the fog is too low or it's too windy, whatever it may be. So we definitely have times where fresh produce is that the shelves are absent of them in the market.
Are there any medical conditions that you treat in Alaska, in Nome, that you don't see here in Columbus, for example?
Congenital Leukoisomaltase deficiency, CSID, which I don't know if I said fully well. There's an Arctic variant that we test for up here, which we consider it the Arctic variant and a normal variant up here, but it has to do with how the body metabolizes sugar. So that is more prevalent up here. I did not see it in the lower 48. And there are certain genetic conditions I've seen more up here that I did not see in the lower 48. We've seen some acute rheumatic fever in the region, which I did not see commonly in the lower 48.
And you normally come back to Columbus every other month, but you're there for a little bit longer right now. Why is that?
Because I am training our new pediatrician that I'm so excited is here with us. Dr. Rochelle Wilson has joined our staff. So historically, when I am off, we would either have our field clinics or I would be doing video teleconference from wherever I am to provide care or doing consults for the village providers because the inpatient, outpatient village providers, whomever it may be, might call me with questions about care of a sick or complicated child. So I am staying here this month to help get our new pediatrician up and running so she can be familiarized with our system and with the care that we provide here.
Your specialty is working with medically underserved populations. How did that become a focal point for you?
That started, I would say, after undergrad. So, as I mentioned, I was in Alpha Phi Omega, which is a service organization, and I learned the term servant leader. And I think that is a good description of how I want to live my life, of just servant leadership to those around me and seeing what I can provide to make things a little bit better for those around me. So, I worked in a federally qualified health center after I graduated undergrad. Heart of Ohio Family Health Center in Columbus, Ohio. And I did their community outreach program in part, among another number of other things. That included going door to door to do a canvas, a needs assessment of the area where they were going to be building a new health center to determine what kind of services would benefit the community where they would be building. So I learned a lot about the need. And I saw these physicians working to take care of patients who at the time might be uninsured or underinsured before the Affordable Care Act. And that's the reason these federally qualified health centers exist, is they receive subsidies from the government to be able to keep their doors open to provide care to people who otherwise would not be able to afford it. And I saw this work that these physicians were doing, and I decided that's what I wanted to do. So I applied to medical school. And I was accepted to a school out in Oregon, and that started my journey.
Tell me about the pros and cons of living in two different places, one of which being so far away. I imagine it's hard to make long-term plans.
It can be a little bit disorienting at times. I had just flown back yesterday, and I did wake up this morning and I was like, which state am I in? I did have to briefly recall. Sometimes I forget where I have which groceries. And so I might go to the store and buy duplicate or triplicates and then get to my place and be like, oops, I already had this, or oops, I needed to have gotten this. So just keeping track and feeling settled. You know, sometimes I'll start to get into a routine. When I'm in Columbus, I'll go rock climbing with my girlfriends every Wednesday and I'll see my nieces or spend time with my family and friends there. And then I've got to change it up and I'm coming up to Alaska and I'm getting ready to do book clubs with my friends up here. We play Dungeons and Dragons sometimes, and I'll get in that routine, and it can be disorienting to be switching back and forth all the time.
Does anything in medical school prepare you for a remote assignment like this, or is it you had to learn as you go?
I don't know that there, I would say generally no. I certainly not a lot of explicit instruction. I think for those who train in Alaska or for programs that are meant to prepare you for rural medicine, that would be more yes, but that wasn't the case where I studied and where I trained. So it's a lot of on the job learning, and there are some things that I think are hard to plan and prep for. For example, if I've got patients on the island, we need to do blood work at the beginning of the week in case weather prohibits the planes from flying out and bringing that blood work to Nome, because then the sample is going to hemolyze and no longer be able to be processed. If you have a sick child, then you've got to take into account the weather and can I send a medevac out? What's the risk to the medevac team to travel in that weather? What's the risk to the child to not be medevaced in? It's a lot of things that I never previously had to consider that are now part of our daily planning.
So you're a doctor and a logistics manager too. So
A little bit more than I'm used to.
Do you have a multi-year contract? Or are you going to keep doing this for a while?
I do have a multi-year contract. So through the remainder of this year, and then I'll decide whether or not to resign. I foresee this being my forever job for as long as they'll have me, for as long as I'm practicing. I feel like I've landed my dream job because I get to primarily practice medicine up here. Medicine in the lower 48 is rough. It, you know, when you have private for-profit organizations, there's always this push to see more patients, see more patients, see more patients. And the last job that I had in Columbus, we would be scheduled for 30 patients a day, double booked 15-minute slots. And it's nothing short of a moral injury every time you feel like you have to rush out of the room and you can't give that family the time and attention that they deserve and that you know that they want as well. Whereas up here, I get time with my patients. If they need 30 to 60 minutes, I get it. They generally, especially if they're a native beneficiary, have access to the care that they need. If there is a lab that needs done, there's nobody telling me that's too expensive. You can't run that lab for this patient, for example. I get to just do the medicine, have the time with the families, and provide the care that they deserve. So it's really reinvigorated my love for being a physician. I've always loved being a pediatrician, but there were times in the lower 48 that I didn't always love being a doctor because it's really hard to do down there with those pressures and our pretty dysfunctional healthcare system. So I feel like I've really landed my dream job and I'm really in love with the community and the work I do up here. So I'm hoping they'll keep having me.
Well, thank you so much for your time and telling us about your life in Alaska. We've been talking with Columbus doctor Deanna LaBianca. She travels every other month to Nome, Alaska, where she's the only pediatrician for now, but soon to be there'll be another pediatrician serving the remote town there and surrounding villages. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Amy.
And coming up, map books are having a moment, and we will meet someone who wrote the map book for Cincinnati. That is when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. On the same day the book Columbus in 50 Maps was published, a book about our neighbor to the south, Cincinnati, in 50 Maps also came out. The book chronicles the history of Ohio's Queen City through storytelling and detailed maps. Our look at Cincinnati in 50 Maps begins with Nick Swartzel, who edited the book. He's also a general assignment reporter for 91.7 WVXU, Cincinnati's NPR member station. Welcome to All Sides, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So, as a self-admitted map nerd, this must have been the perfect assignment for you. Can you tell us how you ended up working on this book?
Yeah, so I had a previous book that I did with Belt Publishing, Cincinnati Neighborhood Guidebook. They do these map books, as you mentioned, in other cities, including they just dropped Columbus's. They've done Pittsburgh, you know, a bunch of cities across what they call the Rust Belt, which we don't have to debate exactly what that is here, but it in their mind includes Cincinnati. And they asked me to do the book. And I was like, yeah, that sounds fantastic. So collaborated with a really awesome cartographer, Andy Woodruff, who you'll talk to. Yeah, it was a really fun experience.
Now, I mean, you needed a cartographer to actually make the maps, but had you ever in your job at all, like, put a map together, or had you like spent a lot of time looking at maps?
Oh yeah, that's I'm a huge map nerd, and that's kind of not a lot of what I do, but there are some stories that I've worked on where it is super important to have some ability of map. I'd say one example is we looked at a kind of landlord that got a lot of complaints in Cincinnati, Greater Cincinnati, and I was able to kind of pull data on like all the properties they owned across all their different LLCs and things, and map that so we could kind of go door to door and talk to tenants and figure out sort of what was going on with those properties. And so it is something that I use in my work occasionally.
How long did you work on Cincinnati and 50 Maps?
It started, Belt asked me to get involved in like, I think, August 2024. And then Andy and I got together via Zoom. I had a bunch of ideas for maps, probably more than he really like knew what to do with at first. So yeah, it took quite a bit of time kind of in the background to put together.
How has your role as a reporter covering Cincinnati shaped your view of the city versus how making a map book has?
Yeah, so I've been covering Cincinnati for like more than a decade now, and most of that time as a general assignment reporter. So I have kind of a breadth of knowledge. Like I know a little bit about everything, and that kind of informed it. I think it's great for a book like this where you're trying to cover a lot of different topics. And I knew enough to kind of dig deeper on some things, and then get what I needed to Andy, and then have him kind of tell me what else I should look into. So, I think that one fed right into the other.
We mentioned map books are having a moment. We said in the introduction, Columbus launched a map book on the same day that Cincinnati and 50 Maps came out. What do you think is the attraction to books like this? Why do people like looking at maps?
Well, I think you can really get lost in a map, especially if you know the area and you love the area. I think they reward close attention, they reward like close reading. And with a book like this, where there's 50 of them, you could look at the same map multiple times and probably see something new. Or, because it's so cohesive and widespread, you could be really interested in one little area one time you look at a map and find something cool about that part of town. And then the next time you look at it, you could be thinking about a whole different part of town and see something new that you like. So I think they just reward repeated and deep kind of reading. And I think that's what people like about them. I also think people are big history buffs, and there's a lot of history in this book.
What do you want readers to learn from Cincinnati and 50 Maps? What's the big takeaway?
I think more than a big takeaway, I think it's the accumulation of all these small sort of revelations as you flip from one map to the next. Like in this book, if you look at some of the first maps, like one of them is an ancient waterway that went through almost the heart of the city. And then if you flip midway through the book, you'll see the course of I-75, which follows that course of that waterway, because that waterway hollowed out the area that highway was going to go through. And suddenly you see like, oh, this is something thousands of years ago that set in motion, one of the major features of our city. And I think they're just like a lot of little revelations like that when you take a look at a number of maps in sequence of the same place.
Yeah, I also feel like they're just for someone who loves their city, right? Like what? Yeah. And there's a quote that you put at the beginning of the book that just made me laugh. I'm gonna read it. It's I was a medium person. I should get to spend eternity in a medium place like Cincinnati. Everyone who wasn't perfect but wasn't terrible should get to spend eternity in Cincinnati. And that's from one of the characters from The Good Place, the TV show. But anyway, it made me chuckle. Is Cincinnati a medium place?
I think Cincinnati is a fantastic place. And what I love about that quote is that Cincinnati loves to hear about itself, I think, in national media or in books and things like that. And I think we sort of vacillate between being really down on ourselves and really, really like hyped about certain things about our city. And I think to hear somebody be like, it's a medium place, it puts us in a good, it's a healthy thing to hear every so often, right? And I think there are really big challenges in Cincinnati, and there are really fantastic things about the city. And when you even them out, it's like, yeah, we're a good place to be. We got a lot to do, we got a lot to work on, but we're still good. We're a good place.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the book Cincinnati and 50 Maps with the book's editor, Nick Swartzel. He's a general assignment reporter as well for 91.7 WVXU. That's Cincinnati's NPR member station. So the book is divided, there's like a table of contents that divides the book into five sections. What are those sections meant to tell us about Cincinnati? Because it's like we're doing the past, we're doing the shape, community and culture. Tell me about the sections.
Yeah, so I think the idea here was to sequence them in a way that gives you some sort of like context for how the city got the way it is first, and then kind of the maps are all about geography, which is about physical space, like the space that we share together. So then, like, here's how things got this way. Here's like kind of the shape of things that we're sharing, right? Like the ground that we're under, or that we're on top of, right? And then fill that in with like things about community and culture. How have we learned to share these spaces? Like, how have we learned to build kind of shared and in some cases, you know, diverse set of cultures in the city? And then you know, there's a whole section about how do we navigate these spaces? Like, how have we learned to get around in this area, and where could we do better on that? You know, like, how could we make it easier to get around our various parts of the city? And then the last part is kind of health and environment. Like, what does this space and what we've done to this space do to us? You know, like, how have we created some challenges and in some cases some opportunities? There's a map about foraging. You know, how does this space nurture us, or in some cases hold us back? And so we tried to tell this story sequentially, like, hey, you're going to get this context, and then, you know, keep that context in mind, because like it's going to inform all these other chapters.
Did you grow up in Cincinnati? Are you?
I grew up in Hamilton, which is right up the road, right up 75, and my mom worked in downtown Cincinnati. And from the age of like 14 on, I was coming down to Cincinnati to skateboard and go to punk shows and do all the things you're probably not supposed to do as a 14-year-old. Yeah, I have a long like relationship with the city for sure, even though I'm from the northern. Well, Hamilton's not a suburb; it's its own little city, but just to the north.
All right. So where or how did you do most of the research for this book? I mean, some of it would be from your own just knowledge from your life there, but where does the research come from?
I mean, there's a broad spectrum of data sources, everything from data the city's collected, U.S. Census data. There's a lot of Ohio Environmental Protection Agency and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency data. There's Sanborn maps from like, you know, earlier last century. There's a real broad array of places that we got the information for the book. And, you know, some of it is informed by reporting I've done. Some of it is stuff Andy knew about. And some of it is things that we kind of just went hunting around for, which was really fun to kind of be like, we want to tell this story with this map, but how do we do that? So, we did also find some, you know, I wouldn't say non-traditional data sources, but certainly newer ones. The cycling map has some of my favorite kind of off the grid cycling routes. And Andy's like, well, you can't just like put those on there because you like them. And so, so like we use Strava to kind of show like, oh, this lots of people do actually use these, even though they're not like technically bike routes. So there's a lot of different sources.
And do you have a favorite map in the book?
This is such a hard question, because I love them all, because we went through like so much work to put them all together. I do like the some of the maps that open up the book, which is the ancient waterway that kind of determined a lot about Cincinnati. I like the Indigenous Earthworks map. I think it's a great reminder of the fact that there were people here before Cincinnati was called Cincinnati. The aforementioned bike map I love, because I'm a cyclist. I could go on and on. There's so many that I think are interesting.
Did you make any map suggestions that didn't make it into the book?
Yeah, there we had between the two of us, Sandy and I, cooked up over 100 maps, and there are some that didn't make the cut. I've kind of put them out of my mind for now, because I was so sad that they didn't make it at the time. But the bike map was originally going to be like three different maps, and it was going to be much more sort of in depth in each of the kind of like, oh, these are bike paths, these are kind of like off the grid spaces you can bike, and these are roads that are safer to bike on, or more less stressful, that kind of thing. So there were a lot of series of maps that we didn't end up including. We just maybe boiled them down to one.
Yeah, the company kind of likes the ring too, you know, city name in 50 maps, so, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
When we sent them like 100, they're like, that's not the name of the book.
I got it. I got it. As a reporter for WVXU in Cincinnati, you learn a lot about the city through your reporting. Is there something surprising that you learned while writing this book?
Yeah, I think one of the areas that I really learned a lot about, and I we had more maps on this that we had to kind of cut, but was the tree coverage maps or map. Where we've lost and gained tree canopy is really interesting to me. I think we are a city that prides ourselves on being pretty green, like literally green, like in terms of having a lot of foliage. And I to see kind of where we've lost some of that was eye-opening, around highways and some other places. But then to see where we've added a lot too, there's concerted efforts to really add some more green space. And then I would say in terms of I'll stay on the tree topic for a minute. The foraging map was really fun to work on because that was also a series of more detailed maps. And I like foraging a lot. I love to get my pawpaws and black raspberries and things. But there were some spots I did not know about, and now I'm excited to check them out in the spring.
The idea of the tree canopy, I mean, that came up in it's in Columbus's book as well. It is fascinating to look to see where there is a severe lack of trees because you don't even realize it when you're driving around.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like it's one quick jump from that to thinking about sort of like environmental equity and like who gets to have a nice tree-lined street and who maybe doesn't get to have those things and like what informs those dynamics. I think is really important to think about and to consider for just the pleasure of living in a neighborhood, but also for the sort of like urban heat island effect and all, like air quality, all those things. So oh, trees are nice. We should have trees. It leads you down all these other sort of paths that I think are really important to talk about.
Since you're a reporter at heart, did you come up with a lot of story ideas from this book? Are you constantly pitching your editor or your boss a map idea for the radio?
I have some ideas in my back pocket for when there's some slow news times. I'll say that,
Oh, when's
for
that?
sure.
When's that?
It's not happened so far since this book came out, I'll tell you that.
Okay. Well, so we've said that map books are having a moment. What's the reaction been like to Cincinnati and 50 Maps?
It's been really good. I have heard a lot of like good feedback, people emailing. We've had two different book launch events that both drew tons of people. We had one at our Mercantile Library, which is like this beautiful downtown, not public library, that is open to people. It's not like private, like you can't get in, but that sold out. Like more than 200 people showed up. It's been really great so far. Cincinnati, as I mentioned before, loves to hear about itself and loves to see books about itself. And the thing that I, because Andy did a fantastic job with these maps, making them legible, making them in depth. But I'm always worried that there's like a geology nerd out there or like somebody who's really into one of these subjects who's going to be like, well, that's not right. And I have yet to hear that. I know that it will happen and I know that we'll have a great conversation or I'll learn something from it. But so far, the sort of like deep subject matter experts haven't come out with pitchforks for this book, which I'm really, that's really good.
Yeah, after you print thousands of books, finding out there's an error definitely will hurt your heart. Well, just to end on, whenever we talked about the Columbus and 50 Maps book, I had never really focused on the shape of Columbus much in my life. And just like, so Columbus looks like an octopus. It has tentacles sticking out in every which way. Cincinnati's shape is not quite an octopus because you have Kentucky on the whole one side of it. But what did you come up with? Like, what does Cincinnati look like? It has two middle parts that look like eyes. I don't
Yeah.
know.
I will say that my friends and I refer to the west little segment of Cincinnati as a Cincinnati rat tail. I love those neighborhoods. I don't mean it in a discouraging way. Rat tails are having a moment in fashion, so it's a good thing. Yeah, due to the history of like sort of annexation, and I think the city, the municipal, powers that be wanting to keep access to the river as far as they could, we do have that little string of neighborhoods on the west side that are, only maybe a mile deep, but kind of like go out on that side, and that gives it a nice, kind of like a very fashion forward haircut, I would say.
All right, yeah, and you have those two annexed areas in the middle that are not a part of Cincinnati, and I thought they looked like eyes. So,
I can see it. Yeah, I hadn't seen that before, but I'm not going to be able to not see it now. So
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
you've helped me see my city in a new way. That's
All
like a
right.
great
Well, I didn't think of rat tail, so we're even. We've been speaking with Nick Swartzel, editor of the book Cincinnati in 50 Maps. He's also a general assignment reporter for 91.7 WVXU, Cincinnati's NPR member station. Thank you so much for joining us today on All Sides.
Thanks, Amy. I had a great time.
And coming up, we are going to speak with an Ohio native whose lifelong passion for map making made him the perfect cartographer for Cincinnati in 50 Maps. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Juravich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Growing up in the Dayton area, Andy Woodruff credits Maps of Cincinnati for getting him into cartography. His love of maps, map making, and the Queen City made his work on the book Cincinnati in 50 Maps the perfect assignment for him in collaboration with editor Nick Swartzel. And we're joined now by Andy Woodruff, a cartographer of Cincinnati in 50 Maps. Welcome to All Sides, Andy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So how did Maps of Cincinnati fuel your interest in cartography? Talk to me about how you ended up being a cartographer.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I grew up in the Dayton area, and I always loved Cincinnati. It was kind of like the big city for me. We'd go down to Reds games, and I'd love the trip down there. And then I just was always into maps, honestly, my whole life. I ended up going to school for geography and then cartography. And because I liked Cincinnati so much, whenever we had cartography projects in undergrad or my graduate school, I would use Cincinnati as my subject for those maps. And so when I was really honing my cartography skills, it was always on Maps of Cincinnati. And I did one of the abandoned subway there and a couple others, and an interactive map that was kind of like Google Street View before Google Street View existed. I had a friend there who went around and recorded a bunch of dash cam videos, and we hooked it up to a map. So yeah, really when I was learning in-depth cartography, it was always about Cincinnati because it was had been one of my favorite places.
So this must have been a dream assignment for you. How did you get involved in making this book?
Yeah, it was lucky, really. As I think you've heard from all the other authors of these 50 Maps mm-hmm. books, I was also contacted by the publisher, Belt, they were looking to expand the series, and they found some authors. And in a couple of cases, they paired those authors with cartographers, as in this one and in Columbus. So I was contacted about this as well as doing a Boston book. So I'm also doing one on Boston. And mm-hmm. so I was contacted because I think I was found by all my Boston maps, and they were interested in expanding this series beyond the so-called Rust Belt to other cities, which will be coming out later this year. And so Anne Trubeck, the kind of head publisher, asked, would you be interested in doing a book of Boston maps? But also first, can we pair you up with an author for another city, Cincinnati? And I don't think she even knew that I knew Cincinnati at all at the time. So it was quite lucky for me. And I was very eager to say yes to that.
You were like, well, actually, Cincinnati would be, would that be better for you than Boston? Because you were like, I know that one.
Yeah, no, I mean, I live in the Boston area now, so I know Boston very well. But yeah, I'm glad I was approached to do a map of or a book of maps on a place that I knew and loved, and instead of just some, you know, random city that I don't know.
So we know it's a collaborative process between you and Nick to put this book together. But were there any maps specifically you wanted to create for this book, and you made a point to make sure that they were there?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few. I don't think I had any really at the outset. You may have heard from Nick that, you know, the first time we ever spoke, he already had a list of 30 map ideas or something like that. And sometime after that, I added some of my own ideas. I don't honestly remember what they were at this point. Some of them, Nick, you know, some of the stuff that I really wanted to do, Nick already had on the list. You know, we have to do one on Cincinnati chili. we had to do one on kind of the topography of Cincinnati, which is really important to its story, its shape, and how you get around it. And we had to do one on the abandoned subway line, which is famous in certain circles. And then there's a few I added to the list that I think I mostly just came across them as we were exploring for other maps to do. I'd come across an interesting data set or something like that and say, mm-hmm. we should map this.
Having grown up in the area, is there anything that surprised you, something you learned about Cincinnati that you had never known?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of little things, I think. I grew up near Cincinnati, but not in Cincinnati. So it was kind of a place I would visit, and I never knew it in depth. So a lot of the historical maps, especially, I didn't know the story behind a lot of the city's history, other than some of the basics about, like, say, the park system, or even the ancient course of the Ohio River and how that defined the city's shape today. So quite a lot of the historical stuff was new to me, and just a lot of other little things too, kind of the cultural art maps, things like that. So there's maybe a lot of little tiny surprises throughout this book.
Well, as a map maker, was there an idea that Nick came up with that was a really hard map to put together? Like, what was the hardest map to do for this book?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot, 'cause and there are some that are hard, and one of the hardest, a couple of them were a little bit hard for me, have to do with pollution. And it's not that it's tricky to tell what the story is, but it's a little bit hard to do it in map form. Like, it's really easy to say things have gotten better on this river or the Mill Creek, but it can be a little bit hard to put that in map form in a way that's easy to understand and is related to facts, in this case, certain water quality measurements. And then there's another similar subject on air pollution. Finding the data that works for that story, for that map, is a little bit tricky. And working with these tiny numbers that have very small differences but are meaningful, and getting that into a map that's simple and easy to understand for somebody flipping through this book was a little bit challenging. There was one other one. He wanted to show Spring Grove Cemetery, which is one of these garden cemeteries of the 19th century. It's a beautiful place in Cincinnati. Nick thought that's a very important thing to include in this book, but we just couldn't come up with any map of it that was any better than an old map from 150 years ago. And what that map is in the book is just the old map.
Okay, so sometimes the original is the best.
Yeah.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the book Cincinnati in 50 Maps with the book's cartographer and Dayton native Andy Woodruff. Were there any maps that you suggested that maybe didn't make it into the book? Because Nick was telling us about how he probably had a list of 100, right? And it's supposed to just be 50. Yeah.
There are some I've forgotten. I was listening to Nick talk too, and I've put some of them out of my mind as well. But there's one I think both of us wanted to do, was a map of the age of buildings. I think, as you've seen, there's one of those in the Columbus book, and we see those on the internet from time to time of different cities where you see the whole city, all the buildings shown on the map in different colors, indicating kind of the era that they're built. And you can see how the city developed over time through those. And we both really wanted to include a map of that, but the data that we could get was just not quite good enough. It just had too many holes, too many missing pieces, and we decided we just couldn't do it. So that was a sad one to miss out on, but that we both wanted, I think.
Do you have a favorite in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of favorites. If I had to pick one, I think it's this map of foraging. I think Nick mentioned it. It's a map of trees in Cincinnati, public trees. Most of them are along the street. Some of them are in parks. Public trees that have edible fruit. I really love that. That was one of Nick's ideas, and it was really cool to map. I had just never thought about that, like being able to walk down the street and pick a berry or a pawpaw. I've never had a pawpaw in my life. Now I want to go and pick one off the street. Sadly, the book's designer kind of reeled me in on the icons that I had used on that map, but I still love it.
Okay, yeah. Well, you mentioned before the chili map. So obviously, there has to be a chili map. It's even called in the book the inevitable chili map. But what I didn't know is that they're called chili parlors. Is that just well known in Cincinnati? Are they called parlors?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I like I say, I'm not exactly from Cincinnati, but that sounds right to me. So I think they're called chili parlors. I'm not sure why. I guess I picture people sitting around eating their plates of chili and smoking cigars or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Not sure
So,
what makes it a parlor, but yeah.
yeah. So you had to do a chili map, right? And you did,
Yes.
was it hard to decide whether you were going to map every place one can eat chili, or you just decided, like this is where the original skyline was and that's what we'll focus on?
Yeah, I mean, I don't entirely remember our process on that, but I think Nick was the one who suggested kind of pulling out a handful of the pioneering original places, whether they still exist or not. It is interesting to just see a map, plot a map of every whatever, in this case, chili parlor. But it's better if we can say a bit more and not just show a whole bunch of dots of where things are, but pull out some more interesting information from that.
And then the next page is called Cincinnati's Other Unique Meat, which I hadn't heard of. I don't even know how to say it.
Yeah.
Goetta.
Getta.
Say it again.
Getta.
Goetta. Is that something I should know about?
Yeah, I don't, it's certainly less famous than the chili. I mean, I knew about it, and I even ate some today. I was back home for the holidays, and my dad gifted me a little log of getta. Yeah, it's much more of a local thing, apparently. For some reason, the chili's famous. I guess it just getta hasn't maybe has not spread far beyond the boundaries of Cincinnati, but it's.
It
Yeah,
hasn't,
that actually that
yeah.
was one of my suggestions too. We had this chili map, and then I came in and said, "We got to have Geta on there too." And Nick said, "Yes, it would be a crime not to." So we made sure to get that one in too.
All right, maybe it's just me, but I mean, Columbus is not that far away from Cincinnati, and I had not heard of this so much so I didn't even know
Yeah.
how to say it. So, you are currently based in Boston, and you're working on a book about maps of Boston. Is it
Yes.
easier to create maps for a city like Cincinnati that maybe d that doesn't have such a high national profile as Boston? Which is easier?
Huh, that's a good question. I don't know that it's any easier. It might be easier to cull the set down to 50 maps for something like Cincinnati. Yeah, as you say, Boston has a very high national profile. So, and when I was working on that one, I was thinking probably a lot more about what people from outside the city might be interested in seeing in this book. I think some of the other books are maybe a little more geared towards the people who live there or, who know the place. But yeah, something like Boston where everybody knows it or hates it or whatever. There's a lot of stuff you can show, and it's well known for history, of course. So, you could make 200 maps about just the historical topics alone. So it's challenging for Cincinnati to limit the maps, but maybe a little more challenging for Boston to get it down to the right number.
Yeah, it sounds like you're going to need to make Boston history in 50 maps,
Right.
just the revolution, and then go from there. You are a cartographer. You make maps for a living. So when you're not working on a book about Cincinnati or Boston, what does a map maker do?
Well, yeah, I'm map makers do well various kinds of maps. One thing I used to do a lot, and what a lot of people still do, is digital interactive pieces, either for news media or otherwise. But there's also plenty of us who do what I do now, which is really kind of old-fashioned printed maps. I've done a lot of work on outdoor conservation land maps, trail maps, things like that. A lot of books still need maps, not books that you write yourself, but books that other people have written that they need a map on page 50 of whatever they're writing about, and they find a cartographer to do that. Yeah, I think cartography, for more people, it's probably now digital, web-based, interactive stuff you see on your computer, on your phone that you can touch, and it moves and tells you all kinds of in-depth things. But there's still a lot of people out there still too who just make maps that you hold in your hand.
Could you do a lot of the map making for Cincinnati remotely from Boston, or did you have to make a trip or two back to
Yeah,
Ohio?
no, I didn't make any trips, at least, not for the mapping book. I might have come to visit home or something like that. But yeah, that's a wonderful thing now. A lot of data that you need for mapping is just available online. It's made available by local governments or state governments or other local agencies. They put a lot of work into creating this data, and they make it available for you. And so a ton of the stuff behind these maps is just, I can go online and download it and make the map.
When you do come back to Cincinnati, though, does this book make you look at the city a little differently? Has it changed any views for you?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. There's, you know, things I didn't know about that I will keep an eye out for next time. I haven't really had a chance to visit Cincinnati since the book came out. I came home recently, but, you know, it was a quick trip just to see my family. So I'm looking forward to a chance to have a longer visit and check out some of the stuff that I've helped map.
Yeah, I was just flipping through, and the map of public stairways is interesting. I didn't know Cincinnati had so many stairs.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, it's a hilly city for folks who haven't spent much time there. There's the topography of that city is very important in its history and its definition and just how you get from one place to another. And stairs are certainly a big part of that.
Yeah, I think a map of stairways wouldn't work in Columbus quite as much as right. in Cincinnati. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We've been speaking with Andy Woodruff, cartographer of the book Cincinnati in 50 Maps. Thank you for joining us today, Andy.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
You've been listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And I want to say thanks to our staff, our producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our student producers Iza Huck, Colin Simpson, and Brianna Fortunate. Our student producer at Denison University is Kiara Burson. We also have a high school student producer, Henry Allen. Video production by The Ohio Channel. Board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.